When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Ideas demand action, philosophy thrives through practice, and talk only flourishes when it inspires meaningful deeds. Welcome to the Talk Doesn't Cook Rice podcast with myself, John Staskowski, and Danny Massaro, where we explore thought-provoking concepts and provide practical insights to enrich modern life. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is something. This is nothing. This is a solid. This is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Right, Danny, I suppose we should start this episode with a little bit of an explanation of the new name that we have now got for the podcast, the Talk Doesn't Cook Rice podcast, which came about, like, I think we're both really happy with it now, and as we'll see, I think it's a bit more descriptive of what we actually do and what we want to do with this podcast. But it came about because I was quite amusingly now served with a cease and desist letter for a potential trademark violation of the word ThinkSpace. So there was a bit of an initial flurry, wasn't there, of like, right, what should I do? I was looking at lawyers and stuff because it was pretty, there was a few holes in it, shall we say, that we probably could have questioned or gone back at them with. But I just decided to rebrand. So I've rebranded my business and the name around that. And obviously the ThinkSpace podcast was part of that whole ecosystem. So we just decided, no, we're gonna change it. And the ideal name really for us is the Talk Doesn't Cook Rice podcast. And the reason for that is it's essentially like it's quite an old Chinese proverb, really, is where it comes from. I'll let you explain a little bit as well, because it's a phrase you've used quite often over the years, going back a while. And I think it does just sum up what we're about. It's very much about that pragmatic. You've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to get out there in the world and be people of action. You can't just talk about stuff and be thinking up in your head all the time. Not that you don't want to be thinking. Obviously, that's a huge thing for us. But just constant introspection and reflection and all that stuff can eventually just be paralyzing. You've got to get out there and act and get out in the world, sort of feel and experience and do, which for us is the perfect sort of synopsis for this podcast, really, isn't it? Yes, we're talking about philosophers and concepts and psychologies and different things like that, but ultimately we always try and leave it with, all right, what does this mean? So after this episode today, we always say, and you mentioned it earlier, which we'll get to, we always like to think there's like an immediate, right, you hit stop, take your headphones or whatever out, or get out the car, and you can crack on and you do it and do something with what we've just talked about immediately. So that's what we're about now. So that's why the name has mysteriously changed on people's podcast apps and things. We've got a new logo and stuff. But that's where it's coming from. And actually, I think it's much better now. I feel like it's much more aligned with, like we say, what we're doing, what we're about, and just the direction of things moving forward. So do you want to jump in on that, just like what it means for you there?
Yeah, you hear these things, don't you, over the years, and little quotes and so on, and some of them stick with you. They resonate. God knows where I saw this one. I've seen thousands of little quotes and pictures and all those things. And I think when I was coaching Laura and we were going, trying to be the best squash players in the world and, you know, you beat all the other ones, and Laura was, you had to get like you had to do a lot of chatting and talking and investigating and plotting and planning and thinking and strategies and tactics and objectives and goals and all these things. You're always thinking your way through it. And obviously, as an academic type person myself and a reader, that bit was pretty easy in a way. But at the end of the day, that doesn't count for anything if you don't action it. So if you don't end up with two or three simple like doings, like then, you know, you're just left like in philosophy land in your head. And I learned like talking about things is important, but you know, you don't want to just do action without thinking. And if I was to pick one over the other, it would, especially in sport, it'd be like get stuff done. You know, to talk a lot less and actually get stuff done. And that was, you know, like one thing that I saw Laura in particular. She every single day would, you know, diligently get things done. Okay. And you see that with artists and builders and any walk of life where it's quite, they get stuck in basically. They roll the sleeves up and rather than sitting around thinking, it's like there's no time like the present type thing and in we go. And it's admirable because for me, what that says is the future's better. It's worth it. It's worth cleaning this house up today. It's worth doing my weeding in the garden. It's worth starting to write a book. It's worth starting a painting. It's worth, you know, putting time into this kid today because one day they're going to, you know, benefit from it. It's not just sat around being lazy thinking in a way, which is important. It's actually getting on with stuff. So it is that pragmatic element of a philosophy is only as good as the cash value of it in the end. You know, there's more to pragmatism if you listen to the pragmatic podcast we did, but that's essentially it. The other area of it is a bit that Ken Wilber, who was really good at looking at like human psychology and what made a person tick, he looked at many different philosophies of mind and body and so on and people, and he said that in a way there's an internal and an external side to a person. So there's the Freudian internal psyche that can drive everything and how you mentally think manifests itself out in the world. But then the behaviorist side of things, more of like Skinner and those types of people, were like, no, your mind is affected by your behaviors. So it's your behaviorism, it's what you actually do with your body and what you do in the world that then kind of reverbs back into how your mind feels. So he was saying, well, both are obviously important. You have an internal self and a sort of external self. But he also said you have an individual self and a social self. So some of the things that you do are very much thinking about you're thinking about yourself as an individual, but you're also thinking of yourself all the time as a social being and how it will affect everybody. So you could have an external social part of you, which was more of a community. How do you fit into a working team? So talk doesn't cook rice doesn't only apply to an individual person and what you do. It applies to how you contribute to the team effort, which could be society, it could be your family, it could be just two of you in a relationship, just two of you. It could be a sports team, it could be a team at work. And so, like, you know what I mean? You've got to like get yourself sorted, you know, put your own life jacket on before you sort of save other people. But you've also got to be wary of how you are actionably contributing to others as well, you know. So I think there's an internal and an external aspect to, you know, your behaviors and your thoughts, what you do. But there's also an individual and a social element to it.
Yeah.
So that's talk doesn't cook rice is a lovely way of sort of saying there's action and there's thinking, and if anything, get doing stuff to show and prove what you've been thinking is actually valuable and work.
Yeah, and that's, for me, I've noticed a shift in my own, whether you want to call it philosophy or whatever, in the last maybe 6 months, just aligned with this anyway, but certainly just noticing and seeing, especially in academia and some of the people I used to knock around with, and so just that vibe that I was part of as an academic like a few years ago, just the constant intellectualizing of everything and, you know, writing papers about it and publishing stuff and, you know, talking the talk. And I think COVID for me exposed a lot of this as well, where you had self-professed like critical thinkers and geniuses that often are belittling other people, which some of what I did myself, like, you know, being really honest as well, like especially towards coaches and stuff, being quite condescending sometimes to like, no, what are you doing that for? You should be like thinking critically about that and doing this and doing that, but never really walking the talk.
Yeah.
So it's like, and like I said with COVID, the reason that was relevant for me was I saw all this critical thinking literature and people writing papers on, especially a few American researchers that are quite popular now around like bullshit and misinformation and all that stuff. But they were all hook, line and sinkered by some crazy stuff that went on during COVID. And it's like, that was your chance to shine. All of these self-professed thinkers and intellectuals, and some really, really high profile ones, that was your chance to shine, and you absolutely failed the test that came up. You showed that when it really came to it in the real world lived experience, you didn't walk the talk of what you're preaching. So there's a little bit of that for me in it, just this over intellectualizing, constantly like top trumping each other with papers and stats and data and like who's got the most scientific vocabulary and all these things. It's like, yeah, but when it comes down to it, you've got to be able to do it in the real world.
Yeah.
And that's whether it's like a hardcore scientist, something like that, and or me and you playing golf. And we rock up, and it's like, well, who shoots the lowest score?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you think about this or that. And it's like, can you do it in the...
Yeah.
Talk a good game about the golf swing and equipment and this and that, but who puts the ball in the hole?
Right. Yeah.
That's it. So it's a little bit like that for me as well. Getting out of your head a bit and just getting into the real world and getting your hands dirty and doing what you're talking about.
Yeah. In sports, we've talked in our book, haven't we, about hyperanalysis as well, and this, the TV shows that do sports, and the before and the after is almost the entertainment as well as the game now. It's about opinions. You think about it, I'm in a studio thinking, talking. That's not cooking the rice. They're not out. that's the problem. They're not on that pitch doing that tackle or throwing that dart or hitting that ball, So that's not to say that it's useless, but it's not cooking rice.
Yeah, you definitely both, that's the message, isn't it? You can't be too far in your head.
What is good is when you still, one of the things I recommend to sports parents and other people who are coaches is go and get coached yourself. Go and do a new sport or do a sport yourself. Keep your playing standard up. Do something that matters to you, something maybe in your comfort zone or a bit out of it. Try it. Go into that territory and do it. And you will learn a different way to talk about that thing, probably a more quality way to talk about it, because you've not got lost in your ideas and your image of righteousness, of I am right all the time, because you've closed the distance again. And that can even happen when you're ill, can't it? We're embodied beings, you can be all about health and this and oh, they're just soft and that. You can get ill or taken down, or have two nights bad sleep and a bit of a bad back, and you can go to pieces. And all your sort of positive psychology and things are just totally influenced. And we know that, don't we? Life can come at you, and you sometimes have to survive, and you just have to get through. So that, again, life will, the actionable side of it, it will always reveal itself.
Yeah.
And that's why golf's superb. I've just come back from a golf trip, and lots of the lads have been having lessons, new clubs, new this, new that. And I was thinking of, like, even myself, a little bit of the technique, and went on the practice range at this club and hit like 20 brilliant balls. Got on the first tee, topped it about 10 yards into the bush. Right? Unbelievable. At the end of the day, I didn't get the ball on the green, right? So you learn to shut your mouth, don't you? You don't go and tell the next guy what they're doing wrong with their swing, okay? So it humbles you a bit when you go into actions and you get your hands dirty. And what I've found in coaching, when I've spoke to some coaches who I admire and rate, and I go and talk to them and watch them, a few of them aren't intellectual in any way. And what they will say to me is, you're overcomplicating it, Danny. You're very complicated and you need to simplify it. It's just simple. It's just this. And I hear that loudly, but I can also see the limits of not thinking and just repeating, that as well.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think that I'm any better or worse than them, but it does make me aware that you have to perhaps go back and forward, like we always say, between having moments of thought and reflection and discussion, but you have to try and get it into the action. So at the end of the day on that golf trip, the fourth day of the trip, I just was saying to myself, get this white ball down that fairway on the floor towards that flag. Whereas earlier on in the week, it was all like, because I'd gone back into thought land and watching a few videos, and it kind of ruined me. It also made me very disappointed with myself when it didn't work. Like, because I'd intellectually beat it and sussed it, when I actually had to do it and I couldn't do it, it made me feel a bit, what's wrong with me? And I think that's, I think when you're getting your hands dirty and you're getting stuck in to the daily tasks, the cleaning your house, writing something, looking after children, getting through your days, whatever, working, creating things. I think it's a much better balance than just sat around talking.
I even notice, I'm getting a bit of a rep on the allotment, and I even notice it there, just as you're talking, and people like people who've been there for years, obviously a lot of them are quite getting on in life, they're quite old, but they've been there for years, they've been like growing the key, and it's like, oh, you've got good soil, you bloody good soil on this plot, haven't you? And they're not having a dig, but they're kind of making the point that everything I'm growing seems to be growing really well, and it's like just everything's producing. And they're like, how have you done that? How have you managed to do this? And what do you do there? And I'm like, honestly, I haven't got a clue. Like the extent of my thing is I go on, there's like Gardener's World or whatever website, and it'll be like, right, blueberries, what's the crack with them here? Get a little bit of thing, and it's like, right, sounds kind of thing. You just plant them, just get them in, like just get stuff going. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then you learn. But it's like they're hesitant to, they need you, like, oh, how have you done that? What technique did you use for that there? Have you done this? I don't know. Just put it in the ground and hope for the best.
So you think you're simplifying?
Even that level of stuff, I think people, there's always this notion sometimes that there's a secret or there's a really like, there's a set way of doing things. And there is for some, don't get me wrong. There's obvious do's and don'ts for a lot of things. But in the main, it's like, you just got to have a go. It's like, there's loads I've done this year and planted in there that I won't do next year. But I've only got to that point from doing it. I don't think I ever could have done that, just reading or watching and listening to stuff. You've just got to get your hands in the bloody ground and get a feel and a sense for it with a little bit of knowledge backing you up. You've got a little bit of stuff in your toolkit, but it's like, ultimately, you've just got to have a go.
Yeah. I think one of the things we've talked about and they got to a summary in my study is you've got to work out what makes you personally tick, and there's nothing better than trial and error with doing it. Is there you'll work trying something yourself, and you added to the method, the standardized variant method that tends to work, and the do's and the don'ts of cookery or in a shop, gardening or whatever it is. There's some how to build an engine, so that you also get your own knack and your own way. You know what I mean? We're embodied beings, so we have our own sort of postures and skills and tensions and ways in which we move. And unless you sort of practice that and get that going, unless you use the tools you've got, which is your body, then you're never really going to get that finer detail of knowing, how to do it.
Yeah.
Drive, it's called functional variability, isn't it? In skill learning, you all look the same to the casual observer, but when you really microscopically look at the actions, they looked at people who do the horses, the shoes fitting horses, blacksmiths, and they noticed in expert blacksmiths, they all did it really well. But when they looked at the fine motor skills, they all had slightly different motor skills.
Yeah.
So they didn't hit the shoe in ever the same way twice, but it always landed on the nail type thing, and didn't sort of whack the horse. That's called functional variability. So that's only your own embodied body knows that, how to do it. It does it for you in the same way your heart beats, it grows skin, it digests food for you, it rests, it cleans your liver, all these... the body's doing all these miraculous things. So unless you're allowing that bodily intelligence to take over and get and actually do stuff and use it, it isn't going to fine tune itself, is it? So on some level, you're not going to fine tune yourself into what not mentally makes you tick, what you need to mentally, internally feel, but what externally you need to do. When you do practice yoga or you go running or you do solo practice or repetition work, I think they're really great, skillful people. They know that there are methods and principles and techniques, but there's also this other layer of my feel, my timing, my rhythm, my feel. And you see that with runners, don't you? Paula Radcliffe has had a strange style when she ran. Gabriele Selesi had a little bit of a strange technique. But you could, your golfers have different swings. You could look at the mechanics and people will say, well, actually, the mechanics underneath are very similar. You know, the mechanics, you know, there's weight transfer, there's, you know, there's this coming in here, there's balance, there's, you know, some key things there. But yet, there's also this other layer of how I do it. And I think, you know, back to talk doesn't cook rice. If all you ever do is talk, you never expose yourself or learn the what Richard Dreyfuss, who studied Merleau-Ponty, the philosopher, will talk about. He called it skillful coping, or these, what he also said, these background practices of that your body starts to skillfully cope, you know, beyond the conscious sort of information stage of your brain. So again, getting stuck in is a joy, isn't it, to paint a wall, to try and build something, to stretch yourself in your body. It's not something to be feared and then be embarrassed about if you can't do it. It's a joy to give it a go and allow your body to start adapting.
I used to notice it loads when I used to work in gyms years and years ago, and it's a lot of it's knowledge, isn't it? You know, that tacit knowledge where you can't really explain how you do it, or it's just bodily feel, isn't it? You've just got it in it. It's not declarative knowledge where you could actually, it's more like book knowledge where you can explain it and put words to it. But I noticed in gyms years ago, the amount of guys who would, they're constantly searching, they're reading books, manuals. It's like they're measuring things to the finite, minutest degree of how many grams of protein and this, and how many reps should I do on this set? How should I do like my body splits and all that? You know, like try to get bigger and build muscle. Mm. And I always liked, there was a guy called Martin Birken, I think a Swedish powerlifter he was. Mm. I think he's still around, and he had this term called fuck arounditis. And it was that. He was like, just get in the gym and lift weights. Like that's like the people who are building and getting massive, they're just in the gym lifting weights, learning what the body prefers, doesn't, how it feels, which exercises feel best for your unique physiology and all that stuff. And he's like, all these clowns who are on like forums and reading magazines and all that, they never get anywhere because they're just in their head like trying to justify everything before they do it so it's perfect. He's like, just get in the gym and lift weights.
Yeah.
And you used to see that all the time, which we were speaking earlier in the week, weren't we? Like I've been, again, many moons ago, I used to be a painter and decorator.
Yeah.
And I used to absolutely hate it, but I still do our own decorating at home. I just can't justify paying someone to come in when I can do it myself.
Yeah.
And I hate doing it, and I'm always in a mood and just like, for God's sake, and I'd rather be doing anything else. But I was saying the other day, like doing that this weekend, there is just a sense of, I don't know if you call it achievement, but there's a sense of like satisfaction at the end of the day when you've worked your body, when you've done stuff with your hands manually and you've achieved something and you've gone from a room to like it's all just sheeted up and like bare canvas, and then you gradually do the different bits and then build it up and then you're finished and then the room's back to how you want it. When you go to bed on that night, there's just a certain feeling in your bones that I think just tells you on a psychological level you've done something worthwhile. It's a different level of satisfaction than what I would call like computer work or, you know, like office stuff where people are just on a screen. Yeah. And they're maybe doing, they're quite busy, they're moving spreadsheets around, they're sending emails, they're creating slide decks, all that stuff. It feels busy and stuff. But when you get home on a night after a day like that, you just don't have that same sense. And I think there's some quite deep philosophy in that, and psychology and mental health and everything. When your body hasn't really done anything physical, no matter what you've done mentally, I just don't think it's quite right. There's something not quite right, and your body senses it, and it's like, nah, there's something missing here. You know, when you talk about meaning and purpose and those things,
yes.
Back in the day, that was all dictated by your body, wasn't it? Like this, get food, build shelter. You're always doing something physical in the day. Now, I'm not saying we all need to go back to like doing manual labor and working in factories and doing that, but I still think there's a wisdom in your body that is only ever really unleashed in a way through physical activity and like doing stuff, meaningful stuff with your hands. Your body senses it in a different way. And that, like the one of the focuses we wanted to talk about today, that leads on to Merleau-Ponty, doesn't it? So Maurice Merleau-Ponty was a French philosopher kicking around in the 40s, 50s, same time as Simone de Beauvoir, Jean-Paul Sartre, Camus, people like that who we've talked about quite a bit. And he was, I think he'd probably call himself, or we'd maybe call him an existential phenomenologist, wasn't it? He was into phenomenology and just the human experience and what that's like being in the world.
Yeah.
And his focus, though, was very much around the body and just that lived experience of how we experience and perceive life through that embodied aspect of what it is to be a human being. And we did a workshop a few weeks ago, didn't we, with the membership community that went down really well and resonated with people. And he's just a nice little lens to look on that aspect of, yeah, what it's like to live as an embodied creature in the world and what that means for you philosophically, psychologically, all that stuff. So do you want to lead us into that a little bit, just why you think Merleau-Ponty's an important thinker?
Yeah. Well, phenomenology is the study of lived experience. So it's how it feels to be me in this world, not necessarily how I think it feels to you to do that, because I've done something similar once and I know exactly what you're going through. So phenomenology is the inside out view, and it's a very unique and personal interpretation of the world. And that's what Heidegger basically brought on from Edmund Husserl and said that this needs to go back to the very start of understanding what human beings are and what life experience is. Heidegger said something like, we are subjects in a world of objects. So everything out there in the world is an object, apart from a human being, which is called Dasein, which is a subject. We're subjective. We experience the world subjectively. We're interlinked with the world. We're thrown into the world. We're aware of a past and a future and all them things. We're very subjective. We're quite strange. We're weird. We make things up. We make predictions. We guess. We use memory. So we're very kind of what you might call intersubjective. We know that there are objects and rules in the world, but we're subjective creatures. And he was sort of saying that we'd gone down the path of we've started to treat humans more as if they're objectives, because that's what science does. Science does experiments to basically get to the objective, factual, repetitive truth of a matter, whereas subjective extreme, leaves it way open to, well, there is no actual truth, because it's all about how you interpret it and how you relate with it. And it's everything brand new and unique every single time, depending on who you are and when it happens and, so on and so forth. So basically, it was like, we've got to remember that we're crazily subjective and biases and all those things. But what Heidegger did, he didn't really add in the body to that. Whereas previously, Nietzsche had talked a little bit about the wisdom of the body, that we are embodied beings. And that's then what Merleau-Ponty did after Heidegger. He said, yeah, I like that. I like what you're saying, but you're looking at it only really from like a mental perspective. You're not, for example, taking into account, when you say everyone's a Dasein, what got a being here, you're not taking into account, what if a person loses an arm or loses the mental faculties? Or what about a baby? Or what about a toddler? Or what about an 18-year-old Dasein who's on the getting strong and on the up? Or what about an 80-year-old who's lost all their walking capacities? And how's that, the body, the lived body, we are embodied creatures. Our bodies are just as important as our minds, because we're not brains in a vat. We're not just, like that thing Nietzsche kind of hinted at, that if you could take your brain out and put it in a glass jar all wired up and leave your body there to the over there, where would you be? Would you be in the glass jar where your brain is, kind of thing existing there, or would you be where the body is? Most people kind of have started to go down the lines of, well, I would be where my brain is. Like, that's me who I am, my brain. And Merleau-Ponty was sort of saying that's wrong, because first and foremost, the brain isn't separate from the body. It's just a bit of flesh that's part of it. And yeah, it's right. It has a very important function, and it makes you mainly a human. It does all these things. But there are creatures and things in the world that don't have a brain, that exist but there's nothing in the world that's just a brain with no body. You know, so it's like, we can't just wipe that out. We can't just go around thinking we're just these intellectual minds. I mean, when you bring that back down to practicality, you know, that's where humour can come in, isn't it? Like Ken Robinson's version of, you know, disembodied academics who go to the Christmas do and don't know how to dance. All their bodies are for is to carry their heads around. So there was this, so Merleau-Ponty talked about how people can become disembodied and out of touch with what's really important. And we look at that, don't, when you see sort of overweight people, people who aren't healthy, people who don't train, people who abuse their bodies, plastic surgery, you know, whatever, just my body's just something to be abused and treated as a vessel that just carries me around. You generally see that that doesn't go very well. And also you see practices like yoga and Tai Chi and exercise and these historical things really worship the body and the mind together. And they tend to be more of a whole comprehensive way of being well, you know. So Merleau-Ponty really was bringing this back in, and he brought that into psychology. You know, he was really saying, you know, the excitement. And he called it a chiasm, where it's like an interlinking. You can't unlock your embodied state in the world. So when you go for a run and you feel the air on your face and you feel the ground on your feet and you feel balanced and you've got proprioception and you're moving in relation to the floor and you know, and the world's passing you by and your eyes are looking and perception, like, that is life. That's amazing. That's a joy, you know. So when you go running, notice how privileged you are to actually be moving, you know, like, it's a joy to move and balance and, you know, that kind of thing. And they sort of say that is fundamental to your experience in the world.
I don't think it's a surprise, or certainly something I've noticed over the years, the amount of great philosophers and like the great thinkers, how many of them refer to walking as the best means to, like, I can't remember who it was specifically who said, like, all the best thoughts are conceived while walking. Mm. And that, like, Nietzsche especially, wasn't he? He was out, like, romping around mountains.
Yeah.
Emerson, I know, was big on that. Lots and lots of them have talked about that over the years, like, just being out and about and moving and physically interacting with nature and in the world. Mm. It's all one and the same when it comes to your mind. And I was not testing this, but my niece had got her A-level results last week.
Yeah.
And she rang me up just like, they were slightly better than what she was expecting, but they still weren't great, basically. And she was sort of wasn't expecting to go to uni because she hadn't really put any effort in, wasn't really expecting great results. So she was just sort of, because it was like, she's like, oh, well, a lot of my mates are going to uni, like, should I be going? And she just rang me up and said, what do you think I should do? And just wanted a bit of advice, really.
Yeah.
And I really noticed, I was like, what you need to do, like, after we've been taught, like, just put your phone away. Don't have it on you. I said, get a drink and just go for a walk for a couple of hours on your own. I said, no interacting, no looking at your phone. I said, I know you'll be twitching after a few minutes because it's just what they do, isn't it? And I was like, just go and be alone with your own thoughts for a couple of hours. And I said, I don't mean just go around the block. I mean, go for a proper walk. And I said, just try and tune into what's your gut telling you. What do you feel like? Really, at your core, what do you feel like doing? When you think about all these options you've got, which one in your gut just gives you that, like, sense of, like, no, this is, like, right, instinctively. It just feels nice. Not like, what does it sound like? What does it feel like in your gut? And I could tell it was like talking to a brick wall. She just couldn't appreciate, well, what do you mean, like, gut feeling? It just wasn't a thing. And I don't know if that's typical of, you know, 18-year-olds in this day and age, you've grown up with the internet and everything, or if it's, but I get the sense it could be that. There was just very out of body. It's all,
yeah,
perception is all external. It's like, how are other people seeing me? How will this come across? What will they think if I do that? If I say this, what are they going to think?
Yeah,
it's all very external, and there's very little internal.
Disembodied.
Yeah, it's disembodied cognition in a way. It's
yeah,
it's just out there, and you're like, just, well, what do you want to do? What, I don't know. Yeah, but what do you feel like? What sounds, you know, in your gut, what just feels like right, and you get that bit of a feeling of excitement, maybe a few nerves and butterflies and that, but it just feels,
yeah,
I don't know what you mean. And it's,
yeah,
I think that's very linked into this, how disembodied,
yeah,
we are just as people these days. We're very out of touch with feelings. It's all thoughts and up there, which, like we're saying, is massively important, but you've got to have the body as well. Your body's, I think it was Nietzsche, wasn't it? He said there's more philosophy in your body.
Yes.
Than, do you remember that quote? How does it finish it? In any, it's like there's more philosophy in your body than in any sort of book or, you know, external philosophy elsewhere.
Yeah.
And it's just what he's getting at, isn't it? It's like, listen to your own, tune into your own senses and feelings and vibes that you get and try and make sense of that and go with that rather than try to rationalize everything and overanalyze everything to come to a, like, a rational conclusion. Sometimes it's, you just got to go with your gut, haven't you?
Well, I think, yeah, and I think what we've lingered in, we've kind of gone into the embodiment side of talk doesn't cut rice and the benefits and the importance of the body. And I think there's also another simpler level of it, and it's just action. Yeah. So your niece there really shouldn't have waited to, she should have just gone for a walk. Like, she should have put her shoes on, was gone. Because she's rung you for advice. This is the thing. She's rung you for advice. She's 18, so she's not like, she's three. So she's rung you for advice, and you've given her, you know, obviously, so in her mind, you know, she's, you've got something to, you know, offer her, right? So she's coming. You've given her something. You give her an offering, yeah? You've said that, well, she should just basically get out of the house and go. She shouldn't wait around to think, well, why is that going to work? She should go on the walk, and then afterwards go, I didn't get it. For curls, you went for the walk, whatever. Go again. No. Well, do you want my advice or not? No. Okay, and that's that. Fine. But if she says, I do want your advice again, go for another walk. Go to the same place again. And this time, sit down. But whatever. But at the end of the day, like, the talk doesn't cut rice. It works on a simpler level, not just a, but it's basically do it. It's do it, then you'll feel motivated to do it. So it's like, start it, get going. You know, and this is sort of like actionable side, and I learned this a lot in sort of courses I've done and things I've learned to help people, is there's an actionable side to things and there's a contemplative side to things, but people massively underestimate the action. Like, go out, you know, people get out of the house, just start the thing. And I think when I watch people at any level, any topic, any place, people who, you know, like, when you see someone giving something a proper go and they feel a bit vulnerable and they try, you know, where did we play golf last week with a guy who's partially sighted and he's struggling, you know, to get around the course. And you know what? He tried every shot, right? And it's just heartwarming, you know, because it's like he thinks that it's worth it. He's doing it. He's waiting. He's trying and trying. And then all of a sudden, you know, he hits a flag on a par three and he's made his day. And then he's in, you know, everyone's talking about it and he feels better. He's got bounce in his step. And then that affects the quality of his conversations when he rings home. And at the end of the day, he's put himself into a position and he's tried. He's hit that shot. And many, many shots, he was embarrassing and people, oh, look, unlucky. You've tried to do it. And I think there's it's courage. It's a form of courage. If your daughter, if your niece would have just gone, I'm going, you'd have thought, well, that's courage. Like, because you'd have been aware that, like, it was way out of her comfort zone, but she's gone for a bloody walk and you'd have been impressed. No matter if she'd have found enlightenment or whatever about uni, she'd have been impressed. You'd have been thought, well, she went. And no, she does, not her cup of tea. So I think, like, when you do things yourself and you try stuff and you do things and you see someone else doing it, a workman or a farmer, or, you know, I sometimes see, you know, Leo, like, you're trying to just do something that's you're thinking, you know, they're admitting it's worth it. They're thinking, if I do this, this can happen still. The world isn't shit. You know, the world isn't nihilistically like, well, what's the point? I don't get it. Like, come on, world, serve me up. Like, serve me up the meaning. Serve me up. Like, and I just think it's so easy not to try. It's so easy not to go and do stuff and sit around on your arse and get stuck in debate and confusion and doubt. And, well, you know, I'm not so sure. Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. For me, that's lazy. You know, like in no man's land, when people get in that no man's land, they don't know what to do. They don't know, you know, and I'm wondering, I get this with athletes when they're about to retire. you know, like, oh, in this little, I'm like, look, you're either, you can't be in the army and say, oh, I'm not so sure if, you know, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to stop being in the army next month or next year. I don't know if I, like, your teammates need you there as if you're in fully in the army. If you're on the job, you're on it. So it's like, turn up and put your foot forward, roll your sleeves up and do something. And then you might find some new ideas about it and new perspectives or a breakthrough. And that's a big thing for me, that, you know, that's the core of Talk Doesn't Cook Rice. You know, you know what I mean? You like see a cathedral or a nice piece of art or whatever. What is it that impresses you? You think, I personally think it's like, gosh, somebody at some time on earth built that, put hours and hours and hours and hours into that and care. To me, that's what's more impressive or what hits me more than, you know, the how it looks. I mean, it's nice if it looks amazing, obviously, but it's a very human thing. Someone got off their arse and did it, like, with their own esteem and will, and they did it. And it's simple, really, that, isn't it? It's a simple thing. It's almost too simple because there's no excuses. And, you know, that's why I like, I've got a lot of time for people who may be talking about business and they built their own business. You know, I'm not saying you can't help people. I have time for people who are aware that they haven't done things when they're giving advice on things and speaking generally, and they admit that. You know, I remember I wrote a book about sports parenting and I had no kids. So I knew that. I was like, look, first thing to say is I've never walked in your shoes and I haven't had children. But just generally about what I've seen as a coach who coaches children and parents a lot, these are some of the observations I've made. That's that. Because you can't go in as if you know exactly what the parents are feeling. Like, and even having your own child, you still don't know what that parent is feeling because you're not that person with that particular kid, with that background and so on. So again, I think when you get into your actions and you do stuff, it mellows you down, it humbles you. And that's where I believe the better quality of the intellect and the thinking comes in.
I like Ralph Waldo Emerson had, we did a session on him probably a couple of months ago now as well. And he talked a little bit about the convenience of conformity in many ways and how, and I see that, you see that definitely a lot on social media where it's easy to put the flag in your bio or, you know, support the latest in thing and, you know, just jump on bandwagons. It's politically convenient. It's easy to do. And Emerson was like, no, you get your hands dirty. If you really care about this cause and this thing, get off your backside and do something about it. Don't just talk about it and pretend that you're doing something just by like getting on board and conforming to whatever the thing is. Actually go and do it. Yeah. And you see, you know, when it kicked off with Ukraine and stuff, you saw a few of those guys. It's crazy, but they jump in a van and it's like, oh yeah, I'm driving to Ukraine. I'm going to bring some refugees out of there.
Yeah.
And it's like ultimate skin in the game in a way, isn't it? I'm not just going to say the right things and do the right things in, like, whether it's putting a flag on or whatever it might be. So I'm going to go and do it. And it's like, yeah, I'm not just talking about it. I'm going to go and do it.
Yes.
And it's very much that, isn't it? I see it as well, quite a childlike state. Like, we had a video of Leo, didn't we, in the session we did, like, wobbling his, I think it was like Lego, like bricks, wasn't it? And he was just learning how it was. You could see in, as it was happening, he's learning the motion of the Lego.
Yeah.
In sync with his own body and how he moved, that moved. And
yeah,
it was quite a simple thing to watch, but really, like, wise, wasn't it? You could see he was really getting, like, he was learning like some deep level stuff of just motion and rhythm and all those like different mechanisms that create something different in the world. But that's a really childlike state, isn't it, which I think we lose as adults.
You understand your surroundings through your body because you're interacting with them. You're cooking, you're cleaning, you're touching, you're feeling, you've got grip, you've got balance, you know, then you're a bit more alert to the details and the smells. So you're coming alive, and you know what I mean? I don't play competitive squash anymore, but I miss the feelings of being in the rallies, like, you know, going up and down the backhand wall and you know, actually being in it in that live moment. And to be fair, I don't get that in the gym. I cannot get, that's why I have to work, I put my music on. I don't get that lifting a weight you know, I'm not, because it's just like, but I'm in the gym at least, you know, lifting the weight, because my goal is like shift some weight because I want to be strong. Why do I want to be strong? Because when I go running, I want to feel the floor and the bounce. I don't want to be dragging myself along. I want to run properly, not jog. I want to bounce and I want to put my foot and I want to feel that feeling of speed as well. So without the strength in my legs, I can't do that. You know what I mean? So it's not about everything being instantly fun and not about every action you do, like getting immediate results for it. A lot of talk doesn't cut rice, you know, in a way. It's like you might not get the feedback now. You know, you're putting in little incremental efforts every day in actions, you know, keeping hoovering your carpet so it doesn't, you know, things don't get ground down, cleaning, you know, eating well, making little actionable, you know, cooking a soup instead of going to the can. You know what I mean? There's all so many temptations around where you think, well, there'll be no instant sort of thing, really. Like good behaviors and little things you do that stack up over time. That's action. But it's not like immediate. You know, you've painted your room the other day and gone to bed that night immediately feeling your hands sore and your bodily like feeling. You know, that's a good feeling, you know. But there's a lots of things that you do where over time, you can look at a person, you can look at the face and the hands and the body and the physiology and how they are and be around them. And you know what they've been doing every day for a long time. It's not about necessarily shortcuts to wisdom. It's about doing things all the time. And then the wisdom sort of comes out of you. And the wisdom's often, like we said, you know, like an athlete or a sports. So it's the hardest thing about sports coaching. You cannot transplant that bodily wisdom into a player, can you? You can't put your feel into them. Even mechanical guidance, you might swing and try and get them to feel it. But fundamentally, you know, you can't. They have to earn that. And that is commendable, I think. You know, when you know, I was watching the Athletics last night. You know, there were people coming 12th and 10th and not. But they're still fantastic. And they're in the arena. And they're still throwing it, you know, and they're still running and they're trying, they're sweating, and they're not that far behind some of the others, but it just looked bad on paper, you know, like 1.8 seconds looks like a lot. But, and I was watching a couple of the runners and I was thinking, gosh, how proud would you be as a parent there? They'd come in, you know, 1.9 seconds behind the fastest runner ever in that race. They've come 12th, get no attention, no, you know, but you'd be so proud because it's like, you know what I mean? They've collapsed on the track, they're sweating, rolling around. And I know they didn't win, but inside themselves, they put the best foot forward, you know. And these are the things I talk to athletes about because they forget that. They forget that there's a lot of people in the world who can't raise a finger for anything, just sit around talking. It's like the old quote, isn't it? You know, about the man in the arena quote, and, you know, Roosevelt, wasn't it? You know, about, don't fear the critic. It's about the man in the arena. And it was the big thing about Brené Brown's vulnerability books, weren't it? At least you're the one out there putting your best foot forward. And all the critics aren't doing that. So never fear the critic because you're actually doing it in debatable and things. But that is essentially you. One of your main prizes is in your own sense of I did it, I dignity, I made a positive move. The future's better. You know, you see somebody who's homeless or struggling or has had trauma or something, and you know what I mean? They try and put a nice clothes on or brush the teeth, and they try their best to do the hair, or they're very old and they still try and look nice and smart. You know, it's not just about that they look smart or they're trying. It's heartwarming because they're like, worth it. And I don't, just because I'm in a bit of pain, I don't need to be a pain for everybody else because there's a communal side to it. I might not feel like cleaning the garden up, but the street looks better when everybody cleans the garden. So there's a communal side to teamwork and doing things. And if everybody does that, it keeps society ticking on a nice level, doesn't it? You know.
Right. There we go then. Talk doesn't cook rice. I don't know about you, but I'm going to have some lunch. which actually is right. I've got some wine. That's not a joke. I'm going to go and have some rice, and then I have been shifting some blueberry bushes. Yeah. So I'm going to get my hands dirty with that, and then that's just going to tick over until next summer, where I'm going to be living in a blueberry wonderland.
Yeah.
So the action will hopefully pay off with a few hundred quid's worth of organic blueberries next year, because they cost a fucking fortune if you buy it.
Well, send me some down, because Leo eats about 50 a day.
There you go, so cottage industry, I can get started.
When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore, you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you. This is red. This is green. This is something. This is nothing. This is solid. This is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.